Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Lifelong Carolinas, coming to you tonight from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. I hope everyone's doing well tonight. We've got an exciting show tonight. We've got a good friend of mine and someone that was introduced to me by a good mutual friend, and his name is Doug Kelly. And our co-host tonight is Kevin Clark. Kevin, good evening, and how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you, John.
Glad you're here with us. Well, from the Charlotte area, we've got Ralph Gerrells. Ralph, how are you tonight? We're so glad to have you with us. We really are.
Doing quite well, thank you, and it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, that's great. Well, before we get started, I want to make a couple of announcements that some people might be very interested in. We've got two Carolina Senior Expos scheduled. One is on Tuesday, November the 2nd. That's at Diamondback Golf Club in Loras, South Carolina. And we're going to have some golf after the expo, so it'll be a lot of fun for everyone that can attend. We've also got one scheduled on January the 24th in Brunswick County, North Carolina, actually near Charlotte, North Carolina. It's at the Brunswick County Community College Aquatics Gym, and that's from 10 to 3. So, again, lots more fun, lots of exciting things going on. So stay tuned and check out our Facebook page, Lifelong Carolinas, and we'll keep you abreast of what's going on. So, Ralph, I want to turn the floor over to you. You are an author of what I would call historical fiction. Would you call it that as well?
Oh, yes. Of course, I didn't start out to be a writer. I spent 45 or so years in advertising, marketing, and publishing, but never as the writer of the novel. And even though I took journalism at the University of South Carolina, I had no intention of writing the great American novel. Of course, I don't think I have since, but that's okay, too. Years in marketing and advertising and got ready to retire, and then I tried to figure out what I would do because I pretty well had a full working career. And I thought, well, sitting in a rocking chair on the porch, watching some cars go by or going down to the lake and go fishing, I could take about 4, maybe 5 days of that, and then I'd be bored to tears. So I just have a couple of ideas and that I have had since I was a teenager that dealt with my time going to church. And so I wrote my first novel was Ill-Gotten Gain, and that's a historic fiction religious story novel about the 30 pieces of silver and what happened to them. Frankly, to me, that was an important talisman for Christians everywhere. And without it, I doubt that we would be Christians. But the 30 pieces of silver and how they got from Jerusalem circa 33 A.D. to Charleston, South Carolina, current time. And
well,
so that
now,
ended
now, first
up
of
being,
all, tell everybody who was involved with the 33 pieces of silver, because that's an important point.
Well, Judas, obviously, was given the 30 pieces of silver. And then when he, because he was going to betray or at least indicate to the Romans who Jesus was. And so that was why the kiss and in the Mount of Olives, and that is why he was given money. Interestingly enough, to my understanding, and I haven't, I've been told this and I've been looking for research to document it, but in that time, the synagogue, the Jewish Sanhedrin, the people that ran things, they would pay you if you turned somebody in for breaking one of the Jewish laws. And the Jewish law that that Jesus technically broke was claiming he was God. So that was a violation of their laws. And so by turning him in, Judas would have been paid money. Now, another part of that was that if you lied when you turned somebody in, you were breaking the law. But if you gave the money back, then you were forgiven. And so, you know, the Bible says that Judas threw the 30 pieces of silver back into the synagogue. So I would say that he had followed Jewish law. And then from what we know from the Bible is that that money was used to buy an itinerant graveyard or place for people to be buried that were not part of the Jewish church. So still I had the question mark about why, what happened after that. So they bought a cemetery. And so what I did for the story is using historical, in some cases, actual historical facts, and others just things that I believe would have been possible. Whether or not they did happen or not is not the question, but they would have been plausible. And that's when someone asked me to describe historical fiction, that's my answer, that the story needs to be plausible, if not believable. And so that was taking pieces of history and getting it back to Charleston.
I mean, because you're the author, you're the guy that is giving us a story to read that would describe a series of plausible events. And that's a wonderful thing because, you know, we need a little bit of help when it comes to envisioning what's going on in a story. So that's I guess the job of a historical fiction author. Now I'm very familiar with now down here in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, or actually in the Pawleys Island area, we have the Great Ghost Alice of the Hermitage, or Alice Flagg. And Nancy Rhine, the historical fiction author and the wonderful ghost story author, she wrote a book about Alice Flagg, which followed as much as she could the stories of Alice and got us from her time of birth to when she met a lumberjack, to when she fell in love with him, when she was sent down to Charleston to a girls' preparatory school to be separated from him by her older brother, Allard Flagg. And so those events help us see how her life was. So what you have done in your historical fiction, and by the way now, if I wanted to buy a copy of your book, what's the exact title of it, and where would I go buy a copy, other than if you're out doing one of your appearances throughout the Carolinas?
Well, I was going to say, anywhere I am, there are books in the trunk of the car. But all of my books are on Amazon, and they're actually Jesus Judas is on Amazon.com, on BarnesandNobles.com, BooksAMillion.com, and if you go to any of those stores, they can order one and have it sent in for you. It's for sale on all of the online bookstores, online booksellers, and a lot of individuals' bookstores, if you just ask for it, they can order it if they don't have it on the shelf. And the title of the book is Jesus, Judas, Best Friends Forever.
Okay, so Jesus, Judas, Best Friends Forever by Ralph Jarrells, and you can get it
correct.
At Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and I'm sure other retailers throughout the Carolinas. And so if you want a copy, just go search for it on Google.
Online,
come
the best
up,
way.
I'm sure it will
if
come
you
right
don't
up.
Yeah, if you online if you want to, but if you don't have a bookseller to go to, and I would say that we support the independent booksellers because their business is, thanks to the internet, their business is going away, and I'd like to not be a participant in that. So, your bookseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, anywhere online. And the others are listed there, too. There are four. I've written four books, three in addition to Jesus, Judas, The Ill-Gotten Game was my first. Fiery Red Hair, Emerald Green Eyes, and A Vicious Irish Temper is the story of Anne Bonny from Charleston. And the other book is sort of I spent a lot of years in the automotive parts industry, and so I had a lot of just meaningless facts about cars. And so they are the fourth book is The Essential Automobile, and that has a bunch of it's a compendium of unusual, obscure, and mostly humorous facts about the car.
Well, that's neat. I didn't know that you had a book like that.
Well, again, I couldn't spend time rocking on the porch, so I decided to use the stuff I had from when I was in the automobile industry.
Well, great. All right, well, now tell us, if you don't mind, so that you can whet our appetite with Jesus and Judas, Best Friends for Life. Tell us a little bit about the story so that we'll know why we want to buy a copy. Kevin, how does that sound to you?
It sounds like a good idea to me.
All right, Ralph, the floor is yours.
Well, we know that Jesus was born essentially in the first century A.D. We know he was born. We know that when Herod found out that there was a king, it was his duty, he felt, to try to kill that person. So he killed once he found out about the baby, he killed all infants between the age of birth and 3 years old so he'd be sure he got the Jesus. Actually, one of the wise men essentially told Joseph and what was going on and suggested that they leave the country. Well, that's, first of all, easier said than done, and second of all, it was something that was important. This is aside from the story. I think we have a tendency to forget that Jesus was a practicing Jew. We also have a tendency to forget how hard it was to travel in those years. We think of going from Columbia to Charleston, as a quick jump in the car and go. And that's a couple hours. Things that I bring out in the book, and there's an appendix that has some of these facts in it, is that if you wanted to go, say, from Bethlehem, where Jesus was born, to Nazareth, where they lived, that was 120 miles, approximately. And given their means of travel, which in that case was by foot and a donkey, they could do about 4 or 5 miles, we'll say 4 miles a day. So to think that when Jesus, when Mary and Joseph got the donkey and started heading for Bethlehem, they were looking at a 4.5-day trip. So it's not as quick as most people have a tendency to think, because we don't relate to facts from back then because we have no point of reference. So anyway, the story brings out days and times and how hard it was to travel and some of the dangers, because thieves were all along the road. And so anyway, Jesus is born in Bethlehem. The wise men come and tell Jesus that Herod, tell Joseph that Herod knows about the baby and that they should leave the country. So they decided to go to Egypt. Now, in my book, because it's also logical, they would have gone to Alexandria, Egypt. And these are the reasons why. Alexandria was the largest Jewish community in Egypt. It was something over 300,000 Jews that were living in Alexandria at that time. Also, it was a most direct route between Egypt and Nazareth, and they really had to go to Egypt because all of the land between Nazareth and Egypt was the Roman Empire and therefore Herod's domain. So they go to Alexandria, and by the way, Alexandria at that time was the center of knowledge for the world, the largest museum, the largest library, anything intellectual revolved around Alexandria. And so that's the basis of my story, is they go to Alexandria, and Joseph works for Judas's father. Judas' father in my novel is a furniture builder, and there's some indication that that was correct. And so Jesus, who was a master carpenter, was welcomed. And so that's how Jesus and Judas met. I think there are some preconceived notions that you have to have, and that is that Jesus and Judas were friends. And the reason I say that is if you look at, if you look at the disciples, Judas was the only non-Galilean among the disciples. He was actually a Judean. And so here are 11 guys who were from Galilee, many of them from right around the Sea of Galilee, and this guy from Judea, which is some, you know, again, days travel away from where the others were from. So there had to be some way for Jesus to have selected Judas to be among the disciples, and so that to me indicates a pre-existing friendship. And that's why the book is entitled Jesus, Judas, Best Friends Forever. And there are some things in there that are that explain that relationship, but that's in the book. So
right. Now, Ralph, I have done a little bit of research, and I have found that some people think that Jesus actually put Judas up to betraying him because he needed that to happen for the subsequent events to occur, the crucifixion and all that. What do you think about that?
Again, I think that's ranked among the plausibles. It certainly makes sense to me that it could have been that way, and that's mentioned in the book. I have friends, church friends, that really think that the book is actually, some of them think it's trash, but that's okay. My belief about reviews and negative reviews especially is if you buy the book, you can think of it anything you want to do. If you don't buy the book, I don't want to hear from you. So I submitted prior to publishing the manuscript to three PhD pastors, reverends.
Okay.
All three have the title of Reverend Doctor. And one of them said, I cannot begin to imagine how many hours of research you put into this work on so many levels. I love history and culture and really enjoy your side notes and explanations in the text that provide such interesting and backstory as your story unfolds. That was from Dr. K. Dalton. Dr. Lanny Lanford, who is the head of an ordained minister, but he's also the head of the music department at Spartanburg Methodist University, said there is a song or a hymn, the final verse by Frederick Faber, that quotes, there is a wideness in God's mercy that offers an unusual wisdom. He said, but we make his love too narrow by false limits on our own. We magnify his strictness with zeal he will not own. So in other words, we're the one that limits the image of God, not necessarily the truth of what that image is. He said Ralph Jarrell's has dared to ask out loud questions that many of us have silently questioned. Is there a wideness to be found in God's love and mercy? That's Dr. Lanny Lanford. Dr. David Dalton, just a quick, in an artistic and ingenious way, the author takes the underpinning of Jesus' story that we all know well, the Jesus who is committed to relationships, and creates an alternative dialogue between characters, Jesus and Judas, interfusing their stories in a deeper plot that states the early years living together in Egypt. This friendship is mutual and empathetic in the early years and remains so throughout their lives as the relationship carries into significant eternal infamy. So those are three reviews. Of course, they're good reviews, so I like them. But they have a tendency, these are people who spent many, many years in school. And so I consider them an excellent historic background. As far as Jesus and Judas, as far as Jesus suggesting to Judas that he turn him in, I think we have to accept that that's a possible thing. And, you know, anyone who doesn't doesn't take into account the intellectual side of what's going on. So that's a long long answer to your question. I'm sorry that it's taken so long, but that's the background, and that's how I go about historic fiction. If it isn't plausible, then I don't write about it.
Okay, that's I think that's a very good thing to do. I write a lot of my writing is nonfiction, so I have a little bit of luxury of talking to people and writing down what they say. But when you're writing historic fiction, and again, I'll liken this to Nancy Ryan's book Alice Flagg. She had to make some assumptions, and she did. She made some good ones that were historically correct, and I think a lot of people take that story of Alice Flagg and say, well, okay, that's probably what happened. Now, what is interesting about Alice Flagg is there were seven of them. Back in those days, in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and all throughout the 1800s, people named girls and boys after aunts and uncles, and there might have been a lot of folks named Joshua or a lot of folks named Alice. So it is kind of interesting when you go out to Old Gun Church, and again, this is just from my background of history in as it relates to Alice Flagg. You go out to Old Gun Church, there are eight graves for an Alice Flagg that range all the way from 1820 to the early 1900s. So you've got to make sense out of it, and I think that's what you've done, and that's a very commendable thing to do, because it's tough to do. Don't you think writing historical fiction like you do is a tough thing to do and do well, isn't it?
Well, you've got to be committed if you are going to do a good job. You've got to be committed to a lot of hours of research. And I do that, and sometimes good, sometimes there are times that I wonder why I spend so many hours doing it. But the outcome, if I achieve the outcome that I want to, it's well worth it. I'll tell you something that's interesting that came out in the research for Jesus Judas. The Last Supper was an important part of Jesus' life. And let me say for a moment that the entire story of Jesus, Judas, best friends forever, is based on the King James Version of the Scripture. So it's not like I went in and made up a whole bunch of stuff. There's a framework that I followed, and the King James Bible is the framework I used. Now, part of this is the Last Supper. We never really hear why there was a Last Supper, why the disciples and Jesus got together for a meal. And basically what I've found that I believe is that this was a celebration of Seder, which is a Jewish, traditional Jewish meal. It is designed to remind the current Jews of all that the Jews went through in departing Egypt. So that's what I have come to believe is the reason for the Last Supper. The other thing is when we say the Last Supper, we have a tendency to mentally take the picture that Leonardo da Vinci has provided us. And historically provable and biblically provable, no way that could have happened that way. First of all, in that era, nobody sat for a meal. They reclined. They always reclined on their left side, and they ate with their right hand. Now, why is that? Because in that era, the left hand was used for personal hygiene. So you wouldn't eat where you, well, you wouldn't eat with anything that had to do with your personal hygiene, because they also didn't have toilet paper. That's what they used their left hand for. So anyway, the table would not have been set in the way that Leonardo showed it. Second thing is, it would not have been a straight table. It would have been a C-shaped table, which is called a triclinium. It's a table that was where major meals were served in a Russian, I mean, in a Roman custom. And there was, they would recline on their left side and eat from this table. And there were traditional places at the table that would call for where people would sit. For instance, Jesus, as the host, would have sat on the second place on the left-hand side of the sea. He wouldn't have sat in the middle. That was the position the host sat. To his right would have been John, the disciple that's called the beloved John. And that was because he was the youngest, and he was traditionally, I guess, Jesus' favorite. To the left of Jesus would have been Judas. And Judas would have sat there because that was an honored place. Now, the Bible verifies those two facts. For instance, in too many pieces of paper in front of me. In John 13:23, it says that John the Beloved was seated on Jesus' right. And the reason that is because he was able to, in that seat, lean into Jesus' bosom and ask the question, who is it that's going to betray you? Judas would have sat to his left. And again, biblically, Matthew 26:13 indicates that it says, he who will betray me will sop in the same bowl as I am. And that's, if Jesus was eating and Judas was eating, they would have had to have been next to each other because they ate out of the same bowl. Excuse me. The interesting part of that to me was Peter, who was considered the chief among the disciples, and certainly considered by himself to be the most important, had to have been seated in the servant's place at the table, because the seat totally across from where John was sitting was reserved for the servant of the meal, and the servant's job would have been to wash everyone's feet. But I think that it puts an exclamation point on the fact that Jesus had said that he who would be great will be small, and he who is small or the servant will be great. So he was telling Peter that, you know, calm down a little bit. You're doing too much. So I guess there's just a whole lot that I found that I also found interesting, but that added some light on things that were going on.
Wow, that's an amazing amount of research. And I personally did not know that. Someone that has been in and around churches all my life, I never knew a lot of that. And where did you find all this information, Ralph? That's, I think, an important question. If somebody wants to learn and do like you've done, where did you find all this information?
Well, you know, as bad as people criticize the Internet, it performs marvelously in research if you know the questions to ask. The history of the meals is in a number of different places when you look at Roman life, and there is, you know, various input into what Roman life was like. The Triskelium, they actually found one that was pretty much intact thanks to the volcano at Pompeii. There actually is one intact in that excavation. So that went, again, it's Roman time. Jerusalem was controlled by the Romans, so it was logical to me that the Triskelium is the table that the Last Supper would have been served at. Now, do I know that? Can I prove it? No, I really can't, but I can find references that says that the host of a meal would sit in the second seat on the left-hand arm of the sea. I can find references that say this is the seat of the honored, this is a notable guest, and this is the seat of the servant. That's documentable.
Okay.
And again, part of historical fiction is those are facts that you, at least in the fiction part of it, you assume to be correct, even if they may or may not be. But in this case, I believe that's all absolutely true. But again, that's my belief.
Now, Ralph, back to Da Vinci. Why do you think Da Vinci depicted the Last Supper the way he did?
Politics.
Please explain.
Vinci was employed to do a painting for a basilica, or in this case, it really isn't a painting. It's a mosaic. But he was...
You there, Ralph?
Uh-oh.
You faded out on us, Ralph. You there?
Am I back? Like,
yes, you're back.
Wait a minute.
So now it was good. Political. So now let's proceed forward. This is getting really interesting.
I'm sorry if I must have hit a button. Okay, but anyway, I think it was political. Da Vinci was hired by a benefactor for a basilica to do a major mosaic presentation. And so I'm sure he didn't want to make his benefactor mad. So he did this. Now, there are numerous beliefs about Da Vinci, his relationship to mystical societies that were in existence at that time. And, you know, I think Dan Brown has made a great deal of money off of revealing those mystical societies and what they may or may not have been doing at that time. But no matter where you want to go, no matter what Da Vinci's purpose was, I think the the painting served more purpose than just to say what happened at the Last Supper. So I don't know. John, I tell you, there's so much going on about stuff like that that I did the best I could to carve away anything that was done for, or that would have been done for reasons other than what they present themselves as. I don't want to get involved in the politics of it, but I know that's part of what was going on.
Well, that is just extremely interesting, Ralph, and a perspective that I know many of our listeners will not have heard. And I know that I don't know, but I would like to, I would, to be honest with you, I would like for us to revisit this and maybe have some more time after this show, you know, maybe in a couple weeks or months or whatever. You've got some vacationing to do, but I would love to get up with you and find out more about all this, if you wouldn't mind reviewing your notes.
Because,
again, it's like we're delving into the Da Vinci Code. And as you said, Dan Brown did a lot of research. Now he did. He had to, and we don't know. But people love this kind of thing. I know I do, and I want to find out more about it. So once you take a trip or two, I want to get back up with you and let's talk some more about this. Now this is not the end of our interview, but I'm just saying I want to get back with you on this because it's just fascinating. It's interesting. And I mean, what, Da Vinci Code was one of the most popular films ever made, one of the most popular books ever ever published, and yet we've got more information about one of the most historically important events of all time, which is the Last Supper. So, yeah, we'll get back up with you on this. I mean, do you think I might have at least said it right? You think I got the characteristic and the flavor of it?
Yes. I think, first of all, you know, Dan Brown is credited with all that research, but I don't know a percentage, but a large percentage of the information he presented in that book came from three BBC investigative reporters, and it's published in a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And if the whole concept of Da Vinci Code or what may have been the basis of a Da Vinci, the whole mystery around Leonardo da Vinci and who he is and who he was and why he would have done it is taken up in this book. And it's, again, it's called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And it's written by three BBC investigative reporters. And even though Dan Brown doesn't really give them credit for much of what was done, if you read Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and if you've read and seen the Da Vinci Code, you'll see the factual matter presented in the documentary by the documentary book by the BBC investigators. You'll see a lot of that on the screen and in Dan Brown's book. I'm not here to pan Dan Brown. I've got all of his books, and you know, I'm a fledgling writer, and he's certainly a successful one. So I'm in no strong position to criticize him, other than knowing both books, and one significantly preceded his.
Right. Well, that's interesting. And now I'm going to split off to a very different topic that is extremely popular. It's becoming extremely popular right now, and I think there are some similarities in the popularity of this topic and the research involved. Now, and we haven't discussed this before, and so just field what you can, because I've actually done a lot of research on this. Are you familiar with Glastonbury Abbey in the UK? And that is where it is claimed that King Arthur is buried, along with Queen Guinevere. Are you familiar with that topic?
No, but we are, my wife and I and my son and his fiance have been discussing a trip to Scotland because I want to see Rosalind Castle. Then we would do other things, and Glastonbury is one of the things that is on our list of where we would go. So,
right. Now here is the interesting part about Glastonbury Abbey and the discovery of that body, which I think was about 15 feet below the ground. It was buried quite deeply, which indicates this was a very important person, is that the skeleton of the gentleman is about 12 feet tall. And the skeleton of the woman is about 5.5 feet tall. And that mirrors a lot of popular scuttle that there were giants. And
yes,
the fact that King Arthur may have been a giant is certainly not, I mean, let's face it, if legend is true that he pulled the sword out of the stone, it might be because he was a tall dude and he could do that. So, I mean...
And he was strong enough to. Huh?
Yeah, that's the whole point. If at that point, if he was 16 years old and he was 10 feet tall, he could probably do some things that Andre the Giant, the wrestler, could have only done in his prime. So, you know, Andre was one of the tallest entertainers in the wrestling world. So, you know, the fact is height does matter when you're trying to pull a sword out of a stone. But the whole point is there's a lot of talk about this, and people love the idea. I mean, the idea of giants is clearly written in the Bible with the story of Goliath and David.
Right.
I mean, it's clear. It's written there. There's not a lot we can say about it. I mean, Goliath was about 13 feet tall. Some reports make him 8 feet tall, but some reports, depending on how they measure and those cubits and things like that, you know, somewhere up 12, 13, 14 feet tall. The guy was unbelievably tall.
He's a big guy.
And
yeah.
He was a very big guy. And then you have, and I have recently heard some things about the fact that the stone that David threw was not just an ordinary stone. It had been blessed by the Lord. And to kill a 13-foot tall boy, you're going to have a little bit of help with your artillery.
Well, yeah,
I mean,
and more than just a little rock.
That's the whole point. I mean, was it a small bomb? I mean, you know, just, I guess, getting it out there. I mean, was it a small bomb? What was it that people loved that kind of thing? And I was just asked, I mean, because a lot of people know that I have a podcast called ScaryCast, and we delve in things like this. I've been asked by several people, was this person with King Arthur a giant, or was this one, or was this one? And it's like I've started trying to look into that because, you know, there are, how can I put it? There is evidence that some very strange things happened back then. Do you agree with me on that?
Absolutely. I think it would be well worth your time to read Holy Blood, Holy Grail. I think this goes well beyond, the research goes well beyond things that we know about. And, I mean, the concept that there if you look at anything long enough, you'll find some sort of strange reason behind it. And I guess would best be called the idea of the conspiracy theory. But I think a whole lot of that's actually true, that it's not a theory. It's actually somebody finally talking about it or finally reporting it. Now, you know, I've had people really not happy with me over the books I've written, and it doesn't really bother me a whole lot. I mean, you know, I'm 78 years old. What can they do? But
buy your book and read it. That's what they can do before they complain.
Buy the book. That's what they can do. If you're going to criticize, buy the book and I'll accept it.
Okay, anyway. Now Kevin, I expect you to get a copy of the book after I read it, and then we will discuss with Ralph a variety of things that we question or whatever, but will you read the book along with me, and then before we question Ralph about anything?
All righty.
Kevin, I'm sorry to have left you out of this conversation.
No, sir, not at all. This has been a riveting conversation to listen in on. So I have enjoyed every bit of it.
It really has, and I mean, this is not what I expected. But then again, I think good interviews bring out things that you never expect. Otherwise, why are you doing them?
Yeah.
So well, I think we've got ample material for a follow-up interview.
So
that's my attorney,
and that's really why I do what I do, is I get a great deal of information from the research that I do, and I enjoy it almost as much as I enjoy writing the book.
Yeah, I'll tell you what my attorney says, and it's the truth. He said, just because you think they're after you doesn't mean it's a conspiracy theory and doesn't mean that they aren't after you. And he's right, you know, just because you sound like a crazy man, these things may be happening to you. So that's, you know, keep moving forward. He's a great guy. His name's Thomas M. Roth III from Alexandria, Virginia. He's president of the Alexandria chapter of the Sons of the American Revolution, and he is a card. I mean, you should, you know, the interesting conversations we have we've had for 30 years have been great. So I tell you what, Ralph, this has been just a lot of fun. And I think we've come to a semicolon, not a period. But when are you going to be, you're going on a trip, when are you going to be back and situated that we might could get you on the show again to talk about all this?
Well, I'll be back in September, and I'm supposed to be scheduled to get some new knees in October, so I shouldn't be going anywhere from pretty much the middle of September until until I recover from knee surgery. But just because I'm recovering from knee surgery doesn't mean that my mouth and my brain won't be connected. So anytime.
Well, that's great, Ralph. So we'll hit you up sometime in October to talk with you more about this and other related topics. I'll do some research. Kevin will do some research. And I think we will have a heck of a good discussion. And I am going to recommend this on all of my podcasts for people to listen to, because this has just been, without a doubt, one of the most exciting interviews I think I have ever done. So, Kevin, do you have anything further to add or any questions before we let this guy go? I want to keep it
well,
as long as we can.
Let me just say that it's been a spectacular interview and really enlightening into certain aspects of the story that I had known, and then certain aspects that I really didn't know. And it'll definitely that'll stick with me for a good while, especially come Easter time. I know that'll be there for me.
Well, I appreciate that, Kevin. And to me, the fact that you know some of it and you didn't know some of it will make it more interesting to you. And it helps me in how I structure how I approach the book. That is exactly what I would like to have someone who reads the book to come away with it when they finish, is they know that some of what I said is true, and they believe that some of the other parts of it are at least believable.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you, Kevin, for those comments. And Ralph, again, it's been a pleasure having you here on Lifelong Carolina. It's not Lifestyle. That's a TV network with movies. So on Lifelong Carolinas, we've enjoyed having you. It's been a lot of fun. I'm glad you'll be coming back to see us. Best of luck on your vacations and your surgeries, and we will make good use of the time that you have available to talk with us. So thanks a lot.
Sounds great.
Kevin, thank you.
Listen, getting
you
old is not for sissies, so just know that.
Getting old is not for sissies. That's a great phrase. It's not. I'll have to tell my attorney that phrase to go along with his, so that's good. So anyway, this is Dr. John Stamey and Kevin Clark with Lifelong Carolinas. We'll see you next time. And again, thanks to Ralph Gerald. Ralph, it was just spectacular. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you
soon. John, thank
okay?
you, Kevin. I appreciate you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on.